The Wonders are in breach of contract.
Sorry. I'm really sorry, Mr. White.
Well, don't worry. No one's going to prison, son. It's a very common tale.
Well, maybe for you, but I was in a band and we still have a hit record.
Yeah, you do. One hit wonders. It's a very common tale.
Four young musicians become superstars when their catchy single hits the airwaves. This week, we discuss famous bass players, the golden age of air travel, and what it means to be a teen sensation. We also chat about Disney retheming Splash Mountain before finding out if that thing you do stands the test of time.
Test time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glutton. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Test of Time podcast. My name is James Brief, and joining me for what seems to be like years and years, wait, it's been years, is my friend and podcast partner, Alan Noah.
Hi, that's me. I am Alan Noah. How are you doing today, James?
I'm doing great, Al. How are you?
I am doing just peachy keen, and I wanted to talk about something that happened last week before we start talking about that thing you do. There was this petition that was going around that Disney should change the theming on their Splash Mountain ride to not be about Song of the South. And obviously there are a lot of racial sensitivities right now, and Lady Antebellum change their name to Lady A, and the Dixie Chicks are just the Chicks, and they're retiring Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben and all of these things that are based on racial stereotypes. So it makes sense that people were asking Disney to rebrand the Splash Mountain ride. And the idea that was being kicked around was that it should be rethemed to be about the Princess and the Frog. That's a movie about New Orleans, and there's a bayou theme, so it kind of makes sense. You don't have to change the entire ride. You leave the ride as is. You just change the theming, the characters, and everything. And Disney announced that they are going to do just that. It makes perfect sense. The only thing that doesn't make sense in my mind is, why did they ever brand that ride based on Song of the South to begin with? I mean, it's a very popular attraction. People love that ride. And that movie is like the shame of Disney. It's not on Disney Plus. It's not on DVD or VHS or Laserdisc in America. I think it was in some other countries and regions and stuff. But Disney has been burying this movie for decades. So why did they make the ride about that movie in the first place? It had to just be because people like Zippity-Doo-Dah. That's the only reason I can think of.
Well, I mean, I don't think people saw it that way, the way that people later realize this. And I'm not making any apology for this. I'm just saying this from the empirical data, that Song of the South was re-released in 1986.
Really?
Yes, I'm saying that Disney and the world had not yet reached this collective maturity. Disney had to evolve on this eventually. You know, they were going to do this. It's good that they're doing it now. You know, I just hope, like you, that what comes out of this moment is not just Uncle Ben's Rice and Aunt Jemima and Splash Mountain. I mean, you know, good for everyone doing it now. And yeah, I hope this is not like the most that happens.
Right. No, we need to do better as a nation and a country in addressing systemic racism, in policing, and in terms of economic inequality and so many more important things than changing the theming in our Disney ride. I totally hear what you're saying. But that said, I do think it's important for companies to make these changes and to acknowledge that these things are problematic, and especially to have the new Splash Mountain be all about The Princess and the Frog, which is a movie that has Disney's first black princess. I mean, that's even better. and the ride itself will still be fun. Have you ever been on Splash Mountain?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a great ride. I mean, actually, it's a bad ride except for one drop. But that's the whole Disney Worldification of it. I don't really care about, like, going through the little, like, cartoon. But it has a fantastic drop at the end.
It has two fantastic drops. So clearly, you don't know anything about Disney World.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess it's been many years since I've been on that, so I forgot. They're not both the same. The one that you go through the thorns and you get that famous picture, that's the big one.
Right. And while I'm giving you a pop quiz on Disney, have you ever seen The Princess and the Frog?
No, I haven't. I've heard it's good.
It's really good. And there's a whole part of that movie where there's a guy who does voodoo and he kind of is being threatened by the creatures on the other side. And it's like a little bit scary because, you know, it's dark magic kind of stuff. That could work really well in a ride. Like Disney and their Imagineers could do something fantastic with this ride. I only hope that whenever I get to Disney World after this pandemic that, you know, the ride will be finished by then. Who the hell knows if that'll happen? But I think it's a good thing. It makes a ton of sense. And yeah, good job, Disney, for finally doing it. It took a petition with a million signatures or however many. But let's move on from that to the movie we're going to talk about this week, That Thing You Do. Actually, I should say, That Thing You Do, because there's an exclamation point in the title. Is this the first movie we've reviewed where there's an exclamation point in the title? No, The Naked Gun, right? From the Files of Police Squad?
That's correct. That was definitely an exclamation point. No, I think this will be the second movie with exclamation point in it.
Airplane. Airplane is Airplane with an exclamation point. Forgot about that one. And this was a movie that you picked. Why did you pick this movie, James?
You know, I just want to review this movie because I heard the song randomly and I thought of the writer of the song. Now, you know, this film is written, directed, and stars Tom Hanks, but the writer of the song, That Thing You Do, is Adam Schlesinger. And I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name, but I went to school with, there was a woman on our track team, Jody Schlesinger, so I'm just going to pronounce it the same way she did. And he was famously the lead singer of Fountains of Wayne.
No, he was not the lead singer. He was one of the co-founders. He co-wrote all the songs. He produced a lot of the songs, but he was not the singer.
Oh, okay. My bad. But he was most famous probably for this song here. I'll just play a clip of it. This is Stacy's Mom. Stacy's Mom.
I do also just want to say that, yes, everybody knows Stacy's Mom by Fountains of Wayne. They are an amazing band. Their album, Welcome Interstate Managers, that's the one that has Stacy's Mom. That entire album is phenomenal. Just every single track, all killer, no filler. Highly recommend that album. So, yeah, the guy was just insanely talented.
Yeah, he was a prolific writer. I mean, he wrote a ton of songs. He wrote a lot of songs for The Colbert Report. And apparently he was working on a big Broadway musical with Sarah Silverman about her book that got a lot of awards, The Bedwetter.
He was like the music executive producer on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which was a show that featured a ton of music, like original songs. He wrote songs for the Emmys and award shows and things like that. I mean, yeah, he was definitely well-respected as a go-to songwriter.
Oh, he was actually a EGOT in terms of nominations. He was nominated for a Tony, an Emmy, Grammy, and an Oscar. Yeah, he was nominated for all of those. And we haven't even said it. The reason we say he was, because unfortunately he died at a very young age. He died at age 52 of coronavirus-related complications. It's a real shame. And this movie, Tom Hanks had wrote the film, as I already said, and he had the idea for the song. It had to be something, you know, 60s, that, you know, a pop hit, but he didn't write the song himself. And he just, he had a little competition and there were four finalists and they played them and everyone knew instantly that this was the one. Try to forget you, girl, but it's just so hard to and the second best one you even hear over the closing credits, and it's far inferior to the Adam Schlesinger penned song.
Right, right. So let's just give a little background on the movie itself. So it's about the Wonders, a fictional band in the 1960s that rises to fame off the success of their hit song, That Thing You Do. The four young men in the group are lead singer Jimmy, the replacement drummer Guy, guitar player Lenny, and a bass player that weirdly doesn't have a name. The foursome is also always accompanied by Jimmy's girlfriend Faye. As their song climbs the charts, the band leaves their hometown of Erie, Pennsylvania to go on a cross-country tour with their new manager, Mr. White, played by Tom Hanks. When they break into the top 10, they head off to California, where struggles within the band cause them to break up. Indeed, these Wonders, with their one hit, could potentially be described as a band that doesn't have very many hit singles.
You mean a one-hit wonder?
I'm not following. But anyway, I remember when this movie came out, I remember seeing it in the theater. I feel like it was a pretty big hit. I mean, I think it was at least a modest-sized hit. I mean, definitely I remember the song being played on the radio a lot.
You know, actually, it was not. The film had a $25 million budget, and that's pretty much what it wound up grossing domestically. It opened at number 3 on October 4th, 1996. There was a movie that was dominating the charts. It was the third week at number 1 called The First Wives Club. You ever seen that film?
I've never seen it. I've heard of it.
Yeah, and this film opened at number 3, narrowly edging out by only $100,000. Number 4, it was that film where the Ducks are bad at hockey, and then they're really good, and then they win at the end.
The Mighty Ducks?
No. The other one where they're really bad at the beginning, and the team beats them, kills them, but then they have an inspirational speech, and they beat that same team in a climactic ending.
D2 : The Mighty Ducks?
No, the other one.
D3, The Mighty Ducks, The Ducks Get Duckier.
Yeah, that's the one where after the epic thing where they win the World Junior Olympics, they go back to school and they beat the varsity team.
Mm.
Yeah, so this movie basically opened at the same amount as D3 : The Mighty Ducks. I saw something interesting about this film. It was one of the first movies to be released on the DivX format. That's D-I-V-X. Do you remember that?
Do I remember? I still have 48,000 DivXs downstairs in the basement. It sounds vaguely familiar, but was it like an enhanced DVD kind of a thing?
DivX was this weird DVD format, which had the whole movie on it, but they would sell it to you for like the price of a Blockbuster rental, and you could technically open it whenever you wanted to, but like it would only work once or something. Like it was a weird thing. Circuit City was involved in it. It was a terrible format, and it was a big flop, but I'm sure this film did do well with streaming, because it seems like everyone's seen it.
Yeah, it does. And maybe I'm just thinking it was a big hit because I remember hearing the song all over the radio. But I mean, radio play for the song is obviously different from box office take. So I guess I could just be conflating the two.
Well, the real song, the one written by Adam Schlesinger, it really peaked at number 41 on the actual Billboard number 100. So, you know, it's a life imitating art, which is kind of imitating life. It made it up to number 18 on the adult top 40. So it was a big hit. So you would have heard this everywhere.
Yeah. And when the movie opens, we are introduced right away to the main character, who's not Tom Hanks. It's a guy named Guy Patterson, and he's played by Tom Everett Scott, who immediately I recognized as the husband in I'm Sorry. Have you seen that show?
No, I've never seen it.
It is a hilarious sitcom. It stars Andrea Savage, who's a comedian. Very, very funny. It's on True TV, but the first two seasons are on Netflix. You will like it. I'm speaking to you, James, and you, our audience. It's a raunchy, funny sitcom. Andrea Savage is hilarious. I think her podcast is really funny. The show is great. And he is the husband on that show. And he's aged pretty well. He looks basically the same.
Well, famously, he looks in this film like a young Tom Hanks. So I'm wondering, does he now look like, say, Mr. White in this film? Does he look like Tom Hanks?
He looks, I guess, somewhat Hanks-ish? I don't know. Not like, you know, a dead ringer or anything.
Well, in the beginning of the film, Guy Patterson, he's working in his parents' appliance store. And we also meet these other characters that are in a local little garage band, Jimmy Mattingly and Lenny Hayes. You know why they got their names, of course.
Jimmy and Lenny?
Just the American heroes of Mattingly and Hayes. You remember from Apollo 13.
Okay.
I wouldn't even say America. I'd say human heroes, those brave astronauts. And we reviewed that film. Also, there's two more members of this band. There's Ethan Embry, and there's also Giovanni Ribisi. Giovanni Ribisi plays Chad. And Ethan Embry, he's unnamed in the film. And in the credits, he's actually called T.B. Player, which stands for the bass player. And it kind of plays on the stereotype that the bass player is like maybe not the most mainstream person, and if there's going to be like a wild card in the band, it's you've heard of the bass player.
I mean, I don't think that joke makes much sense. Like, I don't know. Like, as a music fan, I kind of shrug at that joke. Like, okay, fine. I guess some people don't know the names of the bass player, and some people only know the names of the lead singer, maybe the guitarist. But there's a lot of very famous bass players out there, and I just think that joke is kind of lazy. You know who's the bass player in Fountains of Wayne?
No, I do not. Who is it?
Adam Schlesinger.
I knew you were going to say, damn it. I knew you were going to say that. Of course it was going to be him.
Do you know who's the bass player in the Beatles?
It's going to be a trick question. It's either there wasn't, or I know Ringo's the drummer. I thought they all play guitar other than Ringo.
Yeah, Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney played bass on pretty much every famous Beatles song. So there are plenty of famous bass players. Flea, you've heard of Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers?
And from Back to the Future Part 2?
Sure. Bass player. Geddy Lee, Rush. I mean, there's a million of them. I won't just name bass players for the entire podcast episode. But to me, that joke is kind of stupid. And I almost feel like it's a little mean of them to not name Ethan Embry's character. But whatever. The important thing is that their drummer, Giovanni Ribisi, breaks his arm. He's jumping over like a mailbox or a parking meter or something, and he falls and breaks his arm. And now the guys need a drummer. So then they go and ask Guy if he'll sit in with them because they're going to be in this talent show, and the prize is $100. Keep in mind, this movie takes place in 1964, so that is an insane amount of money for these four guys.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting that this is not necessarily the 60s, as in the late 60s and the hippie part. This is a very Americana 60s, and it's very cute locations, a lot of pastel colors, and this garage band, they're playing this very slow ballad, and it's very kind of monotonous. Obviously, Guy, who really knows what he's doing with drumming, he's able to totally do it. And while they're rehearsing, they're actually coming up with their band name. And I do like this scene because bands trying to think of band names is always funny.
Well, I mean, there's that old expression that all of the good band names are taken. And that's a thing that people have been saying for years. And it's a hard thing to do. And Jimmy, the lead singer, is really trying to come up with something that's kind of wordplay based on the Beatles, because, you know, Beatles are a bug if it's B-E-E-T-L-E-S, but the Beatles, the band, are B-E-A-T, like beat, like, you know, a song has a beat. So he wants to do something like that, like the Herdsman, but instead of herd, as in, you know, you're herding animals, it's like things that you have heard, H-E-A-R-D. And that's sort of the thing he's going for. But then Guy, in passing, says, oh, yes, it'll be wonderful. And then Faye, who's Jimmy's girlfriend, is like, that's it, the Wonders, because she knows how Jimmy is trying to think of something you can do a wordplay on. And so she's saying it could be the Wonders, like O-N-E-D-E-R-S. And it's a running gag in the movie that no one knows what the name of the band is. When they get to the talent show that night, they're introduced as the Oneaters.
Yeah, I do love the announcer. This guy, there's a couple of people heckling him, and he's just trying to do the, hey, everybody, it's time for a talent contest. And the people are like, you suck. He's doing, all right, we're going to have fun. And shut up, guys. It made me laugh. I thought it was good. And Guy, we heard earlier when he's talking to his girlfriend, played by Charlize Theron,
a very young Charlize Theron. This is like her like second or third movie, I think.
Yeah, she's got a small role in the film. Apparently, she was the first person cast in the entire film, though. I read that. And he's talking to her earlier in the day, and he's saying that the song is great, but it's not a ballad. It's an upbeat tempo. The girlfriend doesn't really care because she's not a very interested girlfriend. But Guy suddenly decides to play the song with a fast beat, and they're in the middle of a contest, and they basically go with it.
So Guy starts playing the drums much faster than they're used to, and it takes the rest of the guys like a second to catch up, and Jimmy is pissed because this is his song and it's his baby, and how dare this new drummer come in and speed it up. But Lenny, the guitar player, is really into it. You see it like on his face, and he's got a great, just expressive face, Steve Zahn, as Lenny, and they get really into it. The entire crowd gets really into it, and they win the talent show. They get a paying gig at this pizza place over by the airport, and they start to realize that they've got some potential, and they get the idea to record the song. Guy has an uncle who does church recordings, and so they go to the church and they use his equipment to record the song. Did you catch who Uncle Bob is?
Is it the guy from Friday Night Lights? It kind of looks like him.
No, it is not Kyle Chandler. It's Chris Isaak, the guy who sings Wicked Games. He's an actor too. He's turned up in a bunch of stuff. It's the first famous person cameo in this movie, but not the last. There are more. From there, they get this manager. His name is Phil Horace. He like lives in an RV. He's cooking them beans, and he says, look, I'm going to get you guys on the radio. And they're like, yeah, okay, sure. Jimmy's a little bit hesitant about it. But I have found this character fascinating in that they don't explain anything about him. How does this guy who lives in a van and like lives on beans that he cooks in his RV, how does he have so many connections in the radio industry? No one ever says, but he promises he'll get him on the radio, and he does. So I guess he's not, you know, a scumbag.
No, I kind of like that you don't know exactly what happens here. And I think we can guess there's probably, however much money he gets, he's probably paying someone to do it. Or he has a buddy that can play it. The thing is, he knows this is a hit because he went to that second gig that they got, the paying gig, and he was asking them, Faye, at the door who was selling their records, and he's finding out that this thing is selling out. And he's smart enough to know that if the teenagers are going crazy over this, there's something there. And he gets it on the radio. And I do love the scene when they first hear it on the radio, because I think that's probably something that all singers can probably, when they meet another famous singer and they kind of want to, you know, talk about when was the first time you heard your song on the radio. That's probably a religious experience for a musician. I just think that's so great. And these kids are so excited, and they turn on all the hi-fi sets at the appliance store. And I think it's a lot of fun.
It is. It's a really like triumphant moment. I thought it was weird that all the characters are walking around town with like portable radios and headphones so that, you know, they're just listening to the radio at all times. So they'll hear it if the song comes on the radio. But like, they had those in the 60s. Granted, I was not alive in 1964, so I don't know. But I would have expected that portable radios with headphones were a thing that were not around in 1964.
Well, I think they called those things transistor radios. I know they were small, but I don't know if they had headphones. I would imagine you could probably have something like that back then. But there is something that kind of caps their celebration. You hear the latter part of the song, and to Tom Hanks' credit, you only hear the whole song in this movie twice. And right as the triumphant song ends, Guy goes to the camera and just screams, "I am Spartacus!" He's just like so happy. And do you know what that line is, Al?
It's from Spartacus?
It's the climax of the film. Spartacus leads a Roman revolt, and finally the Romans crush it, and they're basically like, "We're going to slaughter every one of you unless you name Spartacus." They don't know who Spartacus is. So finally, Charlton Heston stands up and he goes, "I'm Spartacus." And as they walk over to the Romans to basically kill him, someone else stands up and says, "I am Spartacus. No, I am Spartacus." And this is the trope that you've probably seen over and over. And then basically all 10,000 people stand up. So the Romans don't know who Spartacus is again. And it's a kind of a triumphant line, and it's a catchphrase. And it's definitely something that he would know, this line, but it's a weird reference that most people wouldn't know.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a timely reference in 1964. I don't know that a ton of people got it in 1996, unless you remembered 1964.
If there's a joke about New Coke, you and I are going to get it, and your kids are not. So That's what it is. I think everyone that was our age now in 1996 was like, "Oh, yeah, Spartacus, yeah. But they make it to Pittsburgh, the big city, and there's a big show. Everyone's excited for a lot of bands. The host is Kevin Pollak. He's from everything, but lately he's the father-in-law in Mrs. Maisel, Marvel's Mrs. Maisel on Amazon. And the band is getting ready to play, but their mics don't work, and then the feedback goes on, and the cymbals fall down, and it's just a huge flop.
And while I'm watching that, I'm seeing Horace, you know, their manager, who's standing off to the side of the stage, and he's doing nothing. And speaking of Miss Maisel, you know from watching that show that the manager is supposed to, one, make sure that kind of stuff doesn't happen, and two, if it does happen, start yelling and screaming and making sure someone fixes it. Horace doesn't do anything. And I was watching this scene and thinking, well, Horace is a terrible manager. But not really, because when they leave this show, he's talking to Guy, and he's like, "Hey, don't worry, one bad show, everything's going to be fine." Then he takes him to meet Mr. White, who is Tom Hanks's character. We're about like maybe 30, 40 minutes into the movie before you see Tom Hanks. And he's basically says, okay, he's going to be your new manager. You're going to sign with his label, goodbye forever. Which, again, I find this character intriguing, because wouldn't he want a piece? Wouldn't he want to stay with them? Usually the small-time manager doesn't want to leave once the band is going to make it big, but I don't know. He's very gracious about just passing the baton to Mr. White.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, are you supposed to believe him at his face value that he's doing this out of sincerity, that the band has outgrown him? But I kind of think it's something more simple than that. I think his job is probably to scour small towns and college towns, and the studio doesn't find these people. Someone has to bring them to them, and these are talent agents, essentially. And he probably got, you know, $1,000 for signing over this, or whatever he got. I think he did very well for this, and if he's smart, he might have kept a little piece of his manager contract. But it was a very successful move to put the boys with Playtone Records, because Mr. White, he's able to change a lot of things. The first thing he does is he gets rid of the stupid name, the O'Neaters, and changes them to just the regular Wonders with a W. And I kind of like that Mr. White had this idea of he's going to do like a boy band thing with them. He's going to go, "You guys are all going to wear matching suits and you're all nice boys. Wait, except maybe not you, Guy." And he hands Guy these sunglasses and he's like, "That's your trademark. You never take these off." And people start calling him Shades and he's the bad boy. Like, Mr. White knows how to take a band with a good hit and turn them into superstars.
Yeah, it's marketing. I mean, he knows how to market these guys, and he takes them on a tour of state fairs. As they're going around, you see like a montage of the song climbing the charts, and it goes from 96 to 71 to 49 or whatever. You get the sense that they're blowing up. They meet some other people on the tour. There's this singer named Diane Dane that Jimmy is very taken with, and Faye, his girlfriend, does not really appreciate that Jimmy is spending a lot of time talking with Diane. But as the song is becoming more and more popular, it finally breaks into the top 10. And Mr. White tells the guys, look, this tour is too small potatoes for you. We're not going to play state fairs anymore. We're going to California. That's where the action is. We're going to get you on TV. We're going to get you into a movie. We're going to get you to meet the big shots at Playtone Records. This is the next step. By the way, just a quick sidebar. Tom Hanks liked the name Playtone so much that he made that his production company. That's an actual real record label. They release a lot of soundtracks and songs from TV shows and stuff like that. And it was from this movie.
Yeah, in fact, Tom Hanks's Twitter, when he made an announcement about Adam Schlesinger's death, he started it with, without this man, there would be no Playtone Records. Like, he's the start of it all, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, there's great 60s songs that these fake bands are playing. That woman, Diane Dane, her song sounds kind of similar to Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man. There's like a Temptations-like band. And, you know, it's got this very like 60s vibe to it. Great music in the montages. And you've got the scenes where the girls are chasing them and they're rushing to get them in the car, and it's very obviously a play on what happened to the Beatles.
Yes, of course. And there are many, many, many parallels between the Wonders and the Beatles.
Oh, yeah. And Steve Zahn's character, he loves this stuff because his character keeps trying to hit on women, but he keeps failing. And he's so excited that there's so many fans waiting for them. Jimmy could care less about this. You could kind of tell.
I love the part where they're on the plane to California. First off, you see that Faye is sick. She's got like a flu or stomach bug or whatever. And Jimmy could not care less. And it's Guy who's like attending to her and making sure she's okay. It's not necessarily subtle, hinting at the love triangle, but whatever. There's a part on the plane where there are seats that face each other, which I've never seen on a plane. I mean, you see that on trains sometimes. But I don't know, maybe planes in the 60s had seats like that?
No. This is a corporate jet.
It is? It looks like a commercial plane.
Then maybe they had those. But have you seen pictures of coach class from like the 50s and 60s? It rivals the legroom that you'd see in first class, minus the like full reclining stuff. You used to have so much room.
Right. And you would like get dressed up to ride a plane, and it was like a very fancy affair, and it was like a nice thing, not something you just complained about the entire time.
Oh, yeah. And I love the 60s West Coast vibe that they show. It's a lot of fun. Kind of like if you've ever been out west and you see a place like In-N-Out Burger that has this like, we're like a 1950s diner, 1960s joint, like all the places look like that. They obviously got all the old Cadillacs and Pontiacs, and all the cars are great. And there's this hotel they stay at that's got this great 60s architecture. It's fantastic.
In this section, there's a bunch of cameos. They're on the set of a movie, which is supposed to be like a Frankie and Annette beach movie. And the director is Jonathan Demme, who I think was a producer on the actual movie, That Thing You Do.
Oh, well, Jonathan Demme, do you know who he is?
Yeah, he's a famous director and producer and writer.
Do you know which film we've reviewed of his?
Yeah, it was Silence of the Lambs.
That's right. And do you know which film he directed with Tom Hanks?
Philadelphia?
Yeah, that's the movie.
Right. They do a radio interview, and the guy is like talking really fast about the Wonders, but they don't really say anything except for like, hi, and then that's it.
Oh, I love that DJ. He's got this fantastic, like, 50s, 60s DJ voice. And he goes, but hey, I got some exciting guests on my show today. Here's the Wonders. And he puts on and he goes, all right, boys, thanks a lot for coming. Real nice to see you. It was fantastic.
Well, you know who that was, right?
No, who was that guy? It must have been a famous guy, because that was done so well.
That's Paul Feig.
Oh, that's Paul Feig. Oh, Paul Feig, of course, the famous director, creator of Freaks and Geeks, did some of the most famous Office episodes, Bridesmaids.
And he was in Heavyweights.
And he was the counselor in Heavyweights. That's correct.
How could you forget? they do another interview where it's actually like a legitimate interview with a different DJ. That guy is played by Clint Howard. That DJ is asking the guys about like their musical influences, and Lenny's just like cracking jokes, but you can tell that Guy really knows his stuff, specifically about jazz. And, you know, he kind of impresses that DJ because this is a guy who is a musician, who is a music fan, who knows his stuff about music. And the person who Guy idolizes the most is Del Paxton, who is a jazz legend. And he actually ends up meeting Del Paxton at this jazz bar. He asks the owner of the hotel that they're staying at, who's this character, Lamar, about where's a good place to go see jazz. Lamar quizzes him about some obscure jazz player. Guy knows the answer. So he sends him to whatever bar this is where all the real jazz guys go. And Guy is flirting with the waitress. I assume you know who that waitress was.
Yes, yes. Rita Wilson, Tom Hanks' wife.
Right. And it did kind of seem like, as the director, Tom Hanks was making sure that his wife looked really, really good, which is his right as the director. And she did. I mean, she's a beautiful woman, and he makes her look really good in these shots. But this brings up a point that I wanted to ask you, because while Guy is talking to Del, he mentions that he was stationed in Germany. And that kind of made me curious about how old are these guys, the guys in the band, because they are referred to many times as a teen sensation. Are they really teenagers? If so, they would have to be like 19, and maybe they are, but I don't know. I just was a little bit confused about exactly how old they are. They drink a lot, but I guess back then the drinking age was 18, so that doesn't mean anything.
From my understanding and my 20 years of subscription to Tiger Beat magazine, I can tell you that teen sensation, it doesn't refer to the people in the band. It's the teens that are crazy about them. The Beatles were a teen sensation. These guys are about 21, 22 years old.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, yeah. And Guy was stationed in Germany. And ever since World War II, we've had a base in Germany. There's thousands and thousands of American troops there. He would have most likely been incredibly safe and just stationed in Germany and just stayed there for a year.
Right. And in that conversation with Del, Del gives him all of this advice about, hey, don't worry about your band. Bands come and bands go, but it's important to just keep playing, love the music. He also tells them to keep an eye on your money, which I thought was funny and, you know, good practical advice. But the movie sort of comes to a head when they get to this TV show. It's called The Hollywood Showcase. And the reference to the Beatles playing the Ed Sullivan Show is not subtle. They specifically mention it a couple times of like, oh, this is going to be like when the Beatles played Ed Sullivan. And this is their huge moment.
Yeah, I thought this was actually more of a reference to that show American Bandstand. You know, those kind of shows like the movie Hairspray, that's all about those, like, here's where you could see the bands playing on TV. I just thought it was one of those like variety shows.
No, it's clearly a talk show because like they have like bits going on before that.
Right. And they do interview American and world and a human hero, Gus Grissom, played by Bryan Cranston. You know who Gus Grissom is, of course.
I know who Bryan Cranston is.
Gus Grissom is, of course, the early American astronaut. He was one of the three astronauts that was in the Apollo 1 pod when that disaster happened. And I love his incredibly tacky, like not even PG, like G-rated lame joke. It's basically asking him, so what would you say about going to outer space? And he says, well, I'd say it's out of this world, Troy. And everyone starts laughing. Actually, did you notice the announcer of this variety show, Troy Chesterfield? He's played by an actor named Peter Scolari. Do you know who that is?
No, that sounds familiar.
Peter Scolari is actually Tom Hanks's co-star from his first major Hollywood thing. Do you know what that is?
Oh, Bosom Buddies.
He was the Bosom Buddy. Tom Hanks' big break. That was a 80s show, early 80s. I don't know what the reason was, but they were two straight men that for whatever reason had to pass as women. So they dressed as women, maybe to be able to live in that apartment or something. But they was called Bosom Buddies.
Right. And so this is the big moment for the guys. They are going to make their national television debut. It goes great as they're playing, but they put on these captions on screen. Actually, one of the guys in the control room calls them supers, which is a insider TV technical term. If you want to know the little text on the screen, it's called a super.
Ah, like the guy that fixes your pipes in an apartment building?
Exactly like that. Some people call them Chirons. That's an old like brand name that people still use, even though they don't use the Chiron company. It's like calling a tissue a Kleenex. But regardless, the supers are pretty nondescript. You know, they just say the guy's nicknames. But for Jimmy, it says, careful girls, he's engaged. And Jimmy sees this when he's playing, which is maybe a little unrealistic. I mean, you would think he wouldn't be busy looking at the monitors. He would be focused on the music and playing and everything else. And it's only on screen for 1 second, but whatever.
Right, because of all the experience you have playing on national television, and you know where your eyes are focused. So, I mean, as someone who's done that a lot, I'll just take your word for it, because I've never actually played in front of millions of people.
Well, you're being rather sarcastic, but I have been in many TV studios and I know where the monitors are placed and they are always small. And I imagine that in 1964, they were even smaller and fewer and far between. So yeah, I think I can speak with a little bit of experience. Thank you very much.
Well, I mean, to be fair, there's a lot on that guy's mind. I mean, the New York Mets are brand new and they suck. The Cuban Missile Crisis happened, John F. Kennedy, like, you know, all the events of the Sandlot had happened.
Like the first couple of verses of We Didn't Start the Fire, like all of those things are on his mind? Maybe. But he sees that super and he is not engaged to Faye and he gets very, very mad. And Jimmy is just unbelievably nasty and rude to Faye when it wasn't her idea. She had nothing to do with it. But Faye finally has enough and she breaks up with Jimmy in front of everybody in the dressing room. Jimmy screams after her, I should have dumped you in Pittsburgh. And he's like, I wonder who even made that caption anyway. And it was Mr. White. And he has a great burn on Jimmy. He says, the same person who said you had class. Lenny leaves. He goes off to Vegas with this girl he's been flirting with. And then they finally get to the recording studio, which is what Jimmy has been begging White for the entire movie. He wants to record more songs. They finally get there and Mr. White says, well, you're not recording your own songs. You're recording songs from the Playtone catalog, which is what they did in the 60s. Artists would cover songs from other artists, especially artists that were on the same label. There's a million examples of that. And Jimmy does not like that. And he quits just right there on the spot. And Lenny is still in Vegas. The bass player, we didn't mention, ran off with some Marines like a good chunk of the movie ago. We haven't seen him in ages. They had a replacement bass player. He's excused. And Guy is just sitting in the studio alone, very sad, until Del comes in and they jam together. And it's a really nice moment because everything that Guy had been working for has basically just fallen apart, but he still gets to play with his musical hero. After Guy jams with Del, he goes back to the hotel. Lamar, the hotel owner, is telling him, your friend is sitting in the cafe alone. You better go in there. And they have a little chat. It's mildly flirty, but nothing really happens. I wasn't sure how it was going to end. I thought maybe he was going to like follow her to the airport, which, you know, is just such a cliche thing. That doesn't happen. He just follows her out to like the valet in front of the hotel, stops her from getting in the taxi. They kiss. not once, not twice, but three times. And I remember that because I was watching the movie with my kids and the kids hate kissing and they say, ew. And usually in movies, when there's a big climactic kiss, they kiss once, then they say something like witty, and then they kiss again. But in this movie, there's a third one. So the kids are like, I didn't think they were going to do it three times. Before the movie ends, Lamar looks right to camera, doesn't like say anything, but kind of quasi breaks the fourth wall. I just thought it was weird. Then they do like text on screen about what happened to the four guys in the band. I don't really think it adds anything. There's nothing that particularly interesting about their lives.
You know, I disagree, actually, because, you find out that Faye and Guy do end up together and they open up a music conservatory school and he teaches like jazz composition. So I think you find out that he did have a career in music and that he ended up with Faye and that he also did what he loved. So that was important. You found out that the bass player, Ethan Embry, he goes to Vietnam, gets the Purple Heart, which means he survives at least. Because you do kind of think a guy that's going into the army in 1964, you know where he's going. Steve Zahn's character, like I was saying, he keeps striking out the entire film with every woman. And then he tries like hitting on this, this receptionist at the Playtone Records. And then she doesn't give him time of day. But then when she sees that he's in the big band, the next thing you know, he's marrying her in Vegas. And it's a kind of a joke at the end that you find out that he's now the manager of a hotel in Vegas. And there's a line at the end that says he is now single. But I kind of thought it was pretty bold of Hanks to do when he wrote this film, is that he didn't make Jimmy the total like villain that loses everything, because Jimmy winds up forming a band called the Herdsmen, and with the Herdsmen he has three gold records. So this guy, like, he knew what he was doing. He had a lot of talent. And what's very interesting is that he winds up signing for Playtone Records. So you know, Mr. White, he's a smart guy, and if he's smart enough to know, like, Jimmy, let's talk. You know, you're too talented for us not to sign.
I don't know that Jimmy necessarily re-signs with Playtone. I mean, he signed a contract with the Wonders, and when he walks out of the studio saying, I quit, like, neato, you still owe the record company music. So he's in breach of contract. I mean, Mr. White says that, and he's like, don't worry, I'm not going to sue you, Guy. But he could go after Jimmy if he wanted to, and Jimmy could just, you know, quote unquote, have to make music for Playtone if it's with another band or what have you. There's a million examples of that in the music industry, of artists who hate their managers and who hate their labels, but they keep signing with them anyway. And you're like, you hated that label. Why did you sign with them again? Well, because they kind of had to. I mean, that's just sort of how these things go.
That's actually an interesting way of looking at it. You're right.
Well, James, do you think that thing you do, that thing you do stands the test of time? You could really hear the exclamation point that second time, right?
Yeah. One thing about this film, I'll say, is that there's a lot of things that are very predictable. You know, this is what you'd call your typical band biopic. You know, your typical fictional band rising and falling and then learning at the end what the real lessons are. You know, that's what this is. And I just think that all the pieces are really well done. Tom Hanks, I would be surprised if he has more than like 15 minutes total screen time in this movie. He's only in it a little bit, and he's great. Charlize Theron, she's great in it. You know, all the characters are just very well cast, and all those guys kind of stood up. Steve Zahn, he's great. Liv Tyler, you're just talking about Tom Everett Scott, Giovanni Ribisi. The song is fantastic. I think it's a good song today. It's not just like a fun 60s song. And it's a real tight 100 minutes long. It's a quick movie. It's not amazing. I think you know everything that's going to happen, but it's just charming and it's just well cast and real fun. Steve Zahn is an underrated actor, I think. It's a fun date night movie. It's a likable film. So yeah, it does stand the test of time. What do you think, Al? What about this film does and does not stand the test of time?
Well, we've said it in the podcast countless times. When you're doing a period movie, it's a little bit of a cheat in terms of helping it stand the test of time, because all of the things in this movie are dated because they're supposed to be. It takes place in 1964. And, you know, a lot of those things are charming. You know, I think even just the fact that the rock and roll players wear suits, you know, like that's not a thing that musicians wear now. I mean, remember when Maroon 5 played the Super Bowl and Adam Levine was shirtless? Like, just the idea of a musician wearing a suit, I think, is kind of nice. And maybe it's not very rock and roll and it didn't even last all through the 60s. But hey, you mentioned biopics. And to me, I think that the text at the end of the movie about like what happened to the characters made it kind of seem like this was a biopic about a fictional band. And that kind of annoyed me a little bit. I'm like, you don't need that. I get it. They're going to live happily ever after. And who cares? I thought that it was trying too hard to be like that kind of biopic when it didn't really need to be. I almost kind of like it better that it's all fictional, because that means that in the 1990s, someone had to write an amazing 1960s song, and Adam Schlesinger did that. The song is phenomenal. I think the success of the movie is definitely dependent on the song. If the song had been terrible, I don't think that the movie would have been as good, especially considering the fact that they play it during the movie a lot, many, many times. They are a one-hit wonder. I really wish they didn't say it at the end when Mr. White says to Guy, well, you're the Wonders and you only had one hit. You know, the story of the one-hit wonder, that's a thing in the music industry. I was like, aw, why'd you have to say it? Couldn't you have let the audience figure it out? Couldn't you have let that one annoying guy in the movie theater say, get it, get it? They're the original one-hit wonders. Get it? I don't know. I wish he hadn't said that. Also, the bass player, like I was saying, I thought it was mean that they never gave him a name. I also thought it was a missed opportunity that they never really explore what happens with his love interest. You see Ethan Embry's character flirting with one of the other musicians that they're on tour with, and it's a young black woman. And that's really interesting in 1964. Like, what's going to happen with that relationship? And we don't know, because he just runs off with the Marines and we see him at Disneyland riding the rides with Mickey Mouse. First off, Mickey Mouse doesn't get on the rides with you. Second of all, what happened with his girlfriend? I would have liked to know that.
Yeah, I also wonder if Jimmy slept with Diane Dane. I wonder if there was any stuff going on there that we didn't hear about.
Another thing that definitely stood out to me and is something that I remembered from seeing this movie back in the 90s, there's a lot of talk about kissing, which I think is weird, especially if these characters are, in fact, in their 20s. Like when Faye breaks up with Jimmy, she's like, all of those kisses I wasted on you. And then when Faye and Guy are talking, they're talking about good kissers and was your last girlfriend a good kisser? And then Guy asks her, when was the last time you were kissed? I mean, really good and kissed. Like, it just seems like a Saved by the Bell episode when you hear people talking about kissing that much. So those are things that kind of annoy me. But I do have to say, this movie is really, really fun. I enjoyed the hell out of watching this movie. The kids loved it. We had to break it up over two nights because it was just getting late the first night, and my son was begging me to keep watching, which I thought was great. It is a simple story. It is a fairly by-the-numbers story. I think that's a fair point. You know how the story's going to go. But I think it's really, really well done. I think Tom Hanks did a great job writing and directing this movie. He only directed one other movie, Larry Crown, which I didn't see. But it makes me think, why didn't he direct more? Why doesn't he direct more? Does he not like it? Did this movie just not do well enough? Maybe he likes acting better. Who knows? But I really, really enjoyed this movie. And I will fully admit that, you know, just the news is depressing the crap out of me. And after watching a lot of just, you know, bleak movies and TV shows, I've been watching a lot of Black Mirror, which is depressing the crap out of me. Like, this is a really fun, entertaining movie. If you're looking for a enjoyable way to just kill an hour and a half or an hour 40, whatever it is, like, this is a great movie. I recommend it. I really enjoyed it. I think it definitely stands the test of time.
One thing I'll say also that doesn't really stand up, though, bands. I was just thinking about this. Seriously, name a band that was formed in the last 10 years that's popular. Not whether you like them or not, but even like Maroon 5, they're like 15 years old. Fall Out Boy, these are from the 2000s. Like, what is a new band?
Imagine Dragons, Haim, the 1975, who I love, Best Coast.
I'm just saying, like, mainstream top 40. I know bands exist, Al. Like, they still have that. But the top 40 does not have any of the bands you just listed.
No, that's a fair point. But these things are cyclical. And sometimes it's bands and sometimes it's solo pop acts like Taylor Swift and Katy Perry. And right now, EDM is super popular. But the fact that bands aren't the biggest acts in the world right now doesn't mean that that won't be the case again in a couple of years. But that's going to do it for us this week. Next week, we are going to come back with a very special guest star, Courtney Noah, my wife. She wanted to come on to talk about Moonstruck. I don't know why, but she did. And I mean, she's my wife, so we're going to do it.
I don't know why, but when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie,
that's amore. In the meantime, of course, we want to hear from you. We are at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We hope you have a wonderful 4th of July weekend. Let us know what you're doing. Are you watching Tom Hanks movies? Are you singing 60s songs? Probably. If you're celebrating the 4th of July, you're going to be listening to some 60s songs. And we'll see you next time, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye.